Just a couple of words of announcement here before we get rolling. You will notice in your bulletin that last week's offering was pretty sizable. I can see from here we had $1,737.00. And that is our two times a year offering that was sent off to Virginia Mennonite Conference and Virginia Mennonite Mission. So they have the ability to do the math and divide 1737 into two and divide it equally among the two organizations. I have to probably think about it for a little bit. But in those lines, I wanted to remind you that young man that was here 2 weeks ago who gave the sermon while I was taking a little bit of a break. You may remember Aaron Kaufman if you were here 2 weeks ago. It was just announced on Monday that Aaron will be the new president of Virginia Mennonite Missions. So, yeah, 35 years old, probably the youngest person to ever be in that position. I've not done my research, but I think we can assume that to be true. So, we have had the current president, Lauren Hurst, here several years ago, and the future president, Aaron Kaufman. So, not too bad, Stanton Mennonite Church. Some very good people and good leaders for our denomination and our conference here in Virginia. Now, if you turn to the back of your bulletin, you will also notice at the very bottom that today, it says, is Mennonite Heritage Sunday. Mennonite Heritage Sunday. And it seems a little bit strange to me that we as Stanton Mennonite Church would be observing Mennonite Heritage Sunday because many people in this church don't come from a Mennonite background. Many people have just recently started attending a Mennonite church, this Mennonite church. And for some of you, this might be the first time you ever set foot in a Mennonite church. So it's kind of strange for us as a diverse group to be looking at the history and the heritage of the Mennonites. But there are also probably some people here that can trace your heritage all the way back to the original Anabaptists, our forebearers, the people that gave rise to the Mennonite church. There's probably some here that are descendants of those who first submitted themselves to adult baptisms, and perhaps those ancestors of yours paid the ultimate price for living out their faith. Now, there's a good chance that many of us are somewhere between those extremes, somewhere along that continuum of Anabaptist Mennonite heritage. And what I want to say to you all today before we actually begin is that Anabaptist and Mennonite heritage is more than just tracing your roots back to 16th century Switzerland. The history, the heritage that we are looking at today means that we as Christians, we as Mennonites, are a part of something bigger than ourselves. We are a part of something bigger than just this congregation. We are a part of something bigger than Virginia Mennonite Conference or Mennonite Church USA or the Mennonite World Conference. We trace our roots back 500 years ago to this event that took place in Switzerland, where these men gathered to do something very illegal, to be baptized as adults, as confessing believers, those that said, "We want to follow Jesus." And all of those men, they were killed for that. Not only that, we're a part of something even bigger than that, because the Mennonite church is about continuing the ministry of a peasant Jew that lived 2,000 years ago. We are a part, I know, wow. We are a part of something bigger than ourselves. Part of something even bigger than that, a tradition that traces back 4,000 years. No, wow. Wow. 4,000 years to the calling of Abraham, then known as Abram. God called him and said, "I will show you this land that I will give to you if you just listen to my voice." Mennonite Heritage Sunday, today, we will be looking at those who have come before us, those who have paved the ways, those who, by the world's standards, have wasted their lives. We're looking at lives well wasted. And you will understand that in just a few minutes. But I want to start today by looking at that text that Sylvia read to us. And this is clearly Paul signing off. It's not only the end of his second letter to Timothy. This is the end of his career. And he seems to know that things are coming to an end. So Paul, as he's closing this letter, if you look at the verses immediately following the text that Sylvia read, you'll see that he's signing off. He's saying goodbye to some of his friends. He says, you know, tell Marvin and Florence that I miss them. Tell them that I appreciate their friendship. Tell Garland and Sylvia that I would love to see them again, but I don't know when that might be. Give my best to this person. Tell them that I love them. I may see them again. I may not, but send them my love. he's clearly coming to the end. And we know from church history that Paul was soon killed for his faith. But a more clear sign that he is coming to the end of his time, we can find in verses 6 through 7. And we find this in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 7. "For I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time for my departure is near." Read the rest of it with me, if you will. "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith." What a powerful metaphor Paul uses here. He clearly sees his life as a follower of Jesus as being a struggle. "I fought the good fight. I finished the race." He fought the good race and finished the fight. He doesn't say he won, but he was working. He was struggling. He was trying to do all he could. Clearly, he's saying this life as a Christian, it wasn't the easiest thing for him. He has been persecuted. He has been tortured. He is now in prison. But he has fought the good fight. He has finished the race, and things are coming to an end. But what's that first part there? That, to my 21st century ears, is a little bit strange. "For I'm already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time for my departure is near." What in the world is a drink offering? That is kind of new to me. So I did a little bit of research this week, and I want to share that with you today. Now, the drink offering was a tradition, especially in pagan religions, where a little bit of a fine drink, like a fine wine, was poured out upon the ground. It was given to the gods in that way. It was offered to those deities that the people worshipped. And we find the first example of a drink offering in Genesis chapter 35. And this is when Jacob, who is already seen his ladder, the ascending and descending of the angels into heaven. He's named this place Bethel, which means the house of God. He's gone back to see his brother Esau, and later he revisits that place because he thinks, well, hey, this is God's house. I might as well go back. It's probably a good thing. So when he arrives at the altar that he set up in Bethel, the text tells us that he offered a drink offering. He took some fine wine and poured it out upon an offering, upon probably an animal, and then he lit it on fire. Now this, if we fast forward, let's see, probably about 800 years. If we fast forward about 800 years, we see that this drink offering becomes a ritual for the Israelite people. When Moses has led his people out of Egypt, and he's given the law, we find these instructions in Exodus chapter 29. "This is what you are to offer on the altar regularly each week. 2 lambs a year old. Offer one in the morning and the other at twilight. With the first lamb, offer a tenth of an ephah of the finest flour mixed with a quarter of a hin of oil from pressed olives, and a quarter of a hin of wine as a drink offering. Sacrifice the other lamb at twilight with the same grain offering and its drink offering as in the morning, a pleasing aroma, a food offering presented to the Lord." Now, we are very modern people. We think like modern people. But if we can take ourselves back to those days, this is about 1,280 years before Jesus was born. So what was that, 3,300 years ago? Think like a person from 3,300 years ago. Now, 3,300 years ago, what would their concept of God have been? Where was God? God was up above, right? So if you wanted to give something to God, how are you supposed to get it up into the sky? Well, there's not a lot of options. You could try throwing it, but it keeps coming back down. They didn't know what gravity was back then, but these things kept coming back down. So they want to give God something. They want to give God these fine things, these food items, these drink items. So the best thing that they could do to turn them into a way to get them into the sky, what do you think, Luke? You're all about raising your hand today. I like it. Or Mark, sorry, Mark. Pray. Well, that's good too. But what they did was they would burn these things. And when you light the food and the drink on fire, it turns to smoke and it rises to God. Now, some of the early pagan religions believed that by offering things to God, by turning food and drink into smoke, they were feeding the gods. Now, I don't think that the Israelites actually believed that. I mean, they believed that their God created the heavens and the earth and everything in it. They didn't really believe that they had to feed God. But they understood by offering these choice lambs and choice drink that they were pleasing God by sacrificing it. It meant that they themselves could not enjoy these things, but they were giving it up for God. Now, I know this whole idea of a drink offering, specifically when we look at it from the perspective of wine, can be a bit of a stumbling block for some people. So I want us to kind of think of other drinks, things that you probably enjoy. And the first thing that I want to lift out as an opportunity for you to enjoy is good old Mountain Dew. Anybody like Mountain Dew? Okay, some people are saying yes, some are saying absolutely not. How much does a hint of Mountain Dew cost? Yeah, a hin is approximately 1 gallon. So as they were making these offerings, they gave a quarter of a hin. So it's about a liter or a liter or a quart. It's about the same thing. 32 ounces is approximately the size of a quarter hin. A liter of Mountain Dew usually runs, what, $1.50, maybe $2? Okay, think that for a little bit here. One of my personal favorites, hot beverages, especially on these cold fall days, is coffee. I've never bought an entire quart or liter of coffee, but often if you go into a coffee shop, they have 16 ounces, which would be a half of a quarter of a hin. Yeah, 16 ounces of coffee. You go into a coffee shop, you buy a 16-ounce cup of coffee, it's going to cost you about 2 1/4. So a quarter hin of coffee is going to be about $4.50. Now let's upgrade that coffee a little bit. What if you went to Starbucks and you got yourself a pumpkin spice latte? A 16-ounce pumpkin spice latte costs about $4. So let's put it on the same perspective as this here, a quarter hin. You're looking at about $8 for a quarter hin of pumpkin spice latte. Of course, go into Starbucks later today and say, I would like a quarter hin of pumpkin spice latte. Which would be just about as normal as saying, I want a venti or tall or grande, whatever. I want a quarter hin of pumpkin spice latte. They would charge you $8.50 if they could figure out what you're talking about. Or even just a bottle of water. Water is not free. I have a 20-ounce bottle of water right here. This is still going to be, what, $20 or $2, maybe $1.50? This is Aquafina. It's the good stuff. It is purified. It is double osmosis treated. I'm not sure, but I feel safe drinking it, but it's going to cost me a little bit of money. So imagine that you have your favorite drink. You have a quarter hin of it. You have about 32 ounces of this drink. And you take your pumpkin spice latte. All right, there's a Starbucks over close to Fishersville, Waynesboro, over by where there's like the Cracker Barrel and some other things over there. Go into that Starbucks, and you've got your 2 16-ounce pumpkin spice lattes. Each one costs you $4. And you walk out of that Starbucks, and you go to that little grassy knoll between Starbucks and 7-Eleven, and just take those two items and dump them out on the ground. Wow. What do you think people would say if they saw you doing that? And maybe they're saying, maybe I shouldn't get a drink at Starbucks today. There's something in their pumpkin spice latte. Either that or they're just thinking, what a waste. I don't like to waste anything. If I've got a cup of coffee or a pot of coffee and I'm down to the very bottom, I mean, you all know that the last swig of that coffee, it's not going to be good. It's full of coffee grounds and it's going to be bitter. But I drink it anyways. Because I don't like to waste things. If you've got a bottle of soda sitting in your refrigerator for like a week and it's been open for a while, you know that stuff is going to be flat. What do you think I do? I drink the stuff. I'm not going to throw it out. What a waste to dump this stuff, to throw it, to put it down the drain, dump it on the ground. This seems wasteful to me and I think to much of the world around us. But yet Paul, in today's passage, he's saying that his life is like a drink offering. It is like the pouring out of a quarter hin of fine wine. Now, I think about Paul, and I think about the life that he lived, and I wonder if the people that knew Paul when he was a young man, when he went by the name of Saul, I wonder if they looked at his life and thought, man, what a waste. Here was this guy with this excellent lineage. He was born of the tribe of Benjamin, a Benjamite of all Benjamites. He was a part of his namesake, Saul, the first king of Israel. He was a part of that family line. He called himself a Pharisee of Pharisees. He was zealous. He was the persecutor of those darn Christians. This guy had it all going for him. He had things together. It was going to work for him. He was going to be a big shot in his days. But then he threw it all away. And he became an itinerant preacher, a writer of letters. And he made his living as a part-time tent sewer. So I think about Paul's mother. And Paul's mother, as she reflected on his life, she must be asking herself, where did I go wrong? If only he would just settle down with a nice Jewish little girl, things would be okay. I thought about doing it in a Jewish voice, but I thought that wouldn't be very politically correct. You know, what if my son, why didn't he just settle down and marry a nice Jewish girl? Why didn't he just stay with this job that he was doing? It seems like such a waste to anybody that looks at his life to see him throw it all away to follow this dead peasant Jew, this man killed on a cross. What a waste. And I think that's the point that I want to make this morning. It is that a life lived for Christ, a life poured out for Him, will seem to much of the world to be a waste. It is like taking a quarter hin of fine wine and just, I don't know, pouring it out on the ground. What a waste. But for those of us that are in the church, those of us who have chosen to follow Jesus with our lives, we see this pouring out of one's life not as a waste, but as a sacrifice to our God, a sacrifice which is a beautiful, beautiful thing. So on this day, on this Mennonite World Heritage Sunday, I want to spend the rest of our time together just looking at some of the stories of people that have come before us to bring us to the place where we are today. People that have given our lives meaning, who have given witness to our faith for the last 500 or more years. And when I start looking back on Anabaptist history, I love to go to this specific individual, probably my favorite story from the early Anabaptists, and that's the story of Dirk Willems. Dirk Willems was arrested in the Netherlands, and he was arrested under the charge of being an Anabaptist. That was the charge. He was baptized as an adult, so he was taken off to jail. And the jail in those days, it was an old castle with a converted tower that was used for his prison. So Dirk was confined in this castle tower, and he was going to be sentenced to death. And he knew that he was going to die. So Dirk Willems, he tied a bunch of knots and a bunch of cloths and blankets together, and he used this rope that he made out of blankets to climb out of the window of the tower and to let himself down to the ground. Now, he did this during the cold winter months in the Netherlands. And around this castle, there would have been either a river or perhaps a moat. And because it was so cold, that water had frozen solid. Now, Dirk was evidently a light man, and it could be that he was losing a lot of weight because he had been imprisoned for a while. But because he was so light, he was able to run right across that moat, right across that river, and he was off, and he was almost free, he was almost safe. But the guards saw him. And as Dirk was running across the river, these guards began to pursue him. And as they went across the river, the first one to step foot on that river, boom, right down through the ice. And this guard, he began to call out for help. Somebody help me, somebody save me, come to my rescue. And the other guards, you'll see in a moment in this well-known picture of this event, the guards are just kind of standing back and they're waving their hands around. They're like, we don't know what to do. We're not coming out there. We're not going to try to risk our own life to save you. But thankfully, there was someone else that heard that man's cry for help. Dirk Willems, the guy that now was free, that was surely going to be able to escape because these guards were back here on the other side of the river, he turned around and he went back to help. This is the famous etching of this event. You see the guards off to the side. What do we do? But Dirk went back and he pulled his pursuer, the man that was trying to capture him, out of the icy river and drug him back to the banks to safety. Now, Dirk's act of goodwill went unnoticed. And what do they say? No act of goodwill goes unpunished. Well, it happened for Dirk as well, because he was taken back to the prison and he was locked in a tighter cell, locked in stocks until he could be burned at the stake. Now, it seems to me that Dirk wasted a wonderful opportunity for freedom. He was free. He had gotten away. They weren't going to cross that river to try to save her, try to catch him. It seems like such a waste. But that's the point. A life lived poured out for Jesus will look like a waste to those outside of the church. And we can talk every day about what it might look like to love your enemies, to do good to those that hate you. But when we start looking at real life examples, it just makes so much more sense. This is a life poured out for Jesus. This is a life lived for others, and it cost him dearly. Now, I also think that it's important as we look back on those who have formed our denomination and our belief to look at not only those that have done it well, but also those who have had some mistakes along the way. And I want to tell you a little bit about probably the greatest and best known Mennonite theologian, probably of all times. And you've probably heard me say the name a time or two. This is, of course, John Howard Yoder. Yoder has done more for Mennonite theology than anybody else that I've ever heard of. And Yoder wrote a lot, especially probably his best-known book, if you're ever looking for some sleeping material. The Politics of Jesus. It's an extremely dense book, but it's wonderfully done. He wrote The Politics of Jesus in the year 1972, and then he died of a heart attack in his office at the University of Notre Dame in 1997, a day after his birthday, on December 30th. Just turned 70 years old. Now, Yoder, since the time of his death, he has become more and more well known in people in churches outside of the Mennonite tradition. Because Yoder wrote a lot about what it means to be the church in a post-Christian society. So as our society, as our world around us gets more and more secular, people have been looking to Yoder to teach them how to be the church. So as Yoder has gotten more and more attention lately, and I've given him quite a bit of attention as well. As Yoder gets more and more attention, we Mennonites kind of sit back and you know what? We love it. We love this attention. You know, I've gone so far. I gave some dates there. I know that John Howard Yoder and I were both born on the same day, December 29th. We both were born in the same city, Smithville, Ohio. You know, I've got a lot of similarities with this guy. So we as Mennonites, we like to lift up John Howard Yoder. And we say things like, you know what? I was Yoderian before Yoderian was cool. Don't act like you've never said that before. I was Yoderian before Yoderian was cool. But in the recent months, things have resurfaced again. And we remember that John Howard Yoder was not a man without his faults. John Howard had some sexually deviant activities in his life. He had some unhealthy relationships with women, specifically women that he was an advisor to, doctoral advisor to. And these women have voiced their concerns about this man and about his theology and about using his theology and venerating this man to the point that he becomes, you know, almost a demigod in a sort. And I think it's right to remember that John Howard Yoder was a person, a failed individual who had flaws like the rest of us. I think of the way the Jewish people approach King David. And we think about David. David was a wonderful king, a wonderful leader. David was one of the best kings in all of Israel's history. He was powerful. He's the one that acquired the land in Jerusalem. He's the one that acquired all the materials to build the first temple there. Jews love David. I mean, David is a rock star to the Jewish people. But every Hebrew Bible that I've ever read also tells the story of David and Bathsheba. Every Jew knows that David was not perfect. As wonderful as a leader as he was, they also remember he had his faults. And I think on this Mennonite Heritage Sunday, we need to remember that guys like John Howard Yoder, he wasn't perfect. We can't make him an idol or a demigod. He was a human being like us. And yes, we can learn from his wisdom, but we need to learn from his mistakes as well. Because those of us that don't learn from our mistakes are bound to repeat them. So I want to leave this morning with this thought. Let us learn from the past as we teach for the future. With so many children here in the congregation today, I think it's appropriate to tell a story about my son. You know, I've done that a time or two. Paxton is 3 years old, and he's a normal boy. He loves to play. He loves to play with toys. So far, so good, right? Every boy loves to play with toys. But my son, he loves to play with things that aren't really toys also. You know, one of his favorite things right now is he's got these clips, he calls them. This is actually one of them. Don't tell him I have these. It's just a chip clip. You put it on an empty bag of potato chips to keep in the freshness. Or it's also got a magnet on it. It would stick to a refrigerator. You can put papers and pictures in it. Well, Paxton loves to play with these things. He puts them on his fingers and he does things like that. And on Friday, he was putting them on his lips and pretending to be a duck. I mean, brilliant for a three-year-old. I mean, whack, whack. Funny. So he's doing this as he's lying on the floor in our kitchen on Friday. And as I'm kind of doing my own thing, I'm probably washing dishes or something, I hear him cry out in a muffled voice. And he says, "Daddy, it hurts! It hurts! Daddy, it hurts!" And I turn around, and sure enough, he has this big clip on his tongue. And it made me think, because I was working on my sermon that day, I thought back to those early Anabaptists once again. And I've told this story before about how, again, Anabaptism, it was illegal. But when these individuals, they were arrested, and when they were put on the pyre to be burned at the stake, or when they were locked in the stocks and forced to experience humiliation, people spitting on them and tormenting them, these individuals, they just kept preaching. They just kept telling about the love of God and the grace of Jesus, and they kept singing praises. You know, even as the fires were lit, there are stories about these Anabaptist martyrs singing hymns to God. Some people took their experiences from Jesus, took the example where Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." And they asked for forgiveness for their executioners. And that's when the executioners started using tongue screws. Tongue screws. And sometimes these were screwed into the roof of their mouth to keep their tongues from being mobilized. But actually, I've learned that the most common form of tongue screw was more like a clamp. They put it on the tongue of the Anabaptist, tightened it down, and then it was this heavy piece of metal, and they couldn't talk. This was done just to keep them from sharing the love of Jesus, to keep them from offering forgiveness to other people. It was a way of silencing these Anabaptists in their moments of martyrdom. So I looked at my son, my three-year-old boy, as he sat there in pain with his clip on his tongue. And I thought to myself, maybe I should help him out. But then I thought, maybe it's also time for me to release and remove my own tongue screw. I have this self-imposed tongue screw, this thing that has kept me from sharing these stories of those who have come before us. And I want to share with my son, when it's appropriate in his age range, to tell the stories of people like Dirk Willems and John Howard Yoder. The good things and the bad. I want to tell him the stories that have shaped my faith and I hope will shape his as well. But I don't just want to tell him these stories about people that poured out their life in spectacular ways like Dirk Willems. I want to tell him the story of his great-great-grandmother, my mom's grandmother, who every year at Thanksgiving would have the prayer before mealtime. And we had to wait for so long. She had so many children and grandchildren. We waited forever as she prayed for each one of us by name. Even after she died, they had recorded this Thanksgiving prayer. And they played it every year at Thanksgiving until the tape wore out. I want to share that story. I want to share the story of the grandfather, my paternal grandfather, who I barely knew. But yet one of the memories that sticks out in my mind is getting out of Grandpa's old Ford Granada, the green Granada with vinyl seats. And we went to church with him, and he always had M&Ms for us. We got to choose, peanut or plain. I remember sitting with Grandpa in church, eating M&Ms and singing the hymns. We have stories to tell. We have a history to pass on to the next generation. And we have been given a life that we are called to pour out as an offering, not only to God, but to those who come behind us. Our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. Let's pray. God, may we not forget where we have come from. And may we remember the lives that have been poured out for us, those who have come before us that have passed the faith on, that have given witness and testimony to the grace and love of Jesus Christ, that have been willing to give their lives and pour them out in a way that much of the world thinks is just wasted. But to those of us, Lord, that are in the church, that are part of this tradition, we see that these lives are not wasted. They are a gift to us. They are a gift to you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.